In this session, we move into the world of the New Testament. And in doing so, it's very awkward as to how to go about this, and for reasons very similar to dealing with the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament. The oldest book in the form we now have it is really the book of Amos, and yet we began with Genesis. And Genesis was written 300 or 400 years after, or at least in its present form written after, the book of Amos. So it's hard to deal with the New Testament in similar fashion because some of the earliest writings are not the way the story really begins. But let's begin at least in this way by discussing general information about the period of time into which Jesus was born and the era in which he engaged in his public behavior and ministry. For some time, scholars believe that the Judaism of Jesus' day was relatively uniform, not terribly pluriform. We now know that the Judaism into which Jesus was born was pluralism at its best. As one scholar has said, it was very like modern Protestantism. There were, of course, as we know from the New Testament record, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, the Essenes. We don't know that from the New Testament, however, the Essenes, but we know they were there. There were the people of the land, the Am HaAretz, who were probably rather casual in their practice of their faith. We know that there were other groups, too, that saw their own tradition very differently. Thus, the beginnings of the so-called Common Era reflected a time in Judaism of plurality of viewpoint. For example, we now know that there were many different views as to what a messianic expectation ought to be. Once upon a time, Christians believed that most Jews of that era had a certain set of understandings of who the Messiah would be and what he would do. We now know that that simply is not true. There were many different viewpoints of the messianic expectation. Secondly, in terms of general information, the temple in Jesus' time was the center of economic life for the people, of political life, as well as being a religious institution. It dominated the landscape. It had been in the hands of the Hasmonean dynasty since the great Maccabean revolt, when for a brief period of time the Hebrews were freed from Syria, from the Seleucids. And then, of course, Rome came along and took over all the Middle East. And by the time Jesus arrived, Rome is really in charge of this part of the world. But the temple is still a central economic, political, and religious institution. Thirdly, the synagogue was a house of study, somewhat like the New England meeting house of our early ancestry in this country. But it's hard to describe exactly what the synagogue would have been or must have been like in the first century of this common era for several reasons. One, we know there were synagogue buildings, but we also know that the likelihood of there being very many of them seems not to be the case. For example, a recent scholar, Richard Horsley, has suggested that in Galilee, there may not have been buildings that were called synagogues, but synagogue merely meant the gathering of the people. So it was a community gathering, and they gathered for different purposes and different reasons. But the traditional view and understanding is that the synagogue was not a place of worship in the sense that the temple was, as a place of worship and sacrifice, but was a house of study of Torah and other related literature. Fourth, Galilee was at some distance from Jerusalem, and of course the beginnings of the Christian movement are described as being there in Galilee with the teachings of Jesus, moving about as a charismatic figure, somewhat homeless, traveling from place to place and engaged in teaching some very unusual things in some very unusual ways. And being distanced from Jerusalem, Galilee probably did not have the same attitude toward the temple that people living in the south in the Judean province of the past had toward the temple. The Galileans probably were not greatly influenced by the temple. They probably were not very concerned about it. They probably, in some instances, actually didn't like the functioning of the temple because of its economic characteristics. Fifth, diaspora Judaism, That is Judaism that, as a result of captivity and other activities in the Middle East, where Jews had spread out through the Mediterranean world, diaspora Judaism had taken on a very interesting complexion in that each Jewish synagogue in diaspora apparently had, or most of them had, in their number, God-fearers. This is a rather formal expression, God-fearer, describing a Gentile who joined in a Jewish synagogue because of his or her admiration of the Jewish view of one God, monotheism, and the Jewish understanding of living an ethical or righteous life. But these so-called God-fearers apparently did not accept the full cultic apparatus that went along with Judaism, which is why they were treated with honor and respect by the Jews in the synagogue, but remained simply God-fearers and not fellow Jews. This is important for one reason of interest to scholars. We have long surmised that Paul, the Jew who converted to the Christian movement on the road to Damascus, or so the story goes, went out in evangelistic missions, and the traditional view for a long time was that Paul went to synagogues to try to persuade Jews there that their Messiah had come and his name was Jesus. But failing in that missionary enterprise, he then turned to the Gentiles, and finding there a receptive audience, began to build a Gentile Christian movement. It is much more likely now, with the discovery of the importance of the God-fearers in Jewish synagogues throughout diaspora, that it's these God-fearers to whom Paul turned. And as a matter of fact, in turning to them, he was turning to those who already believed in the God of Israel, who already believed in the patterns of behavior of the Jewish people, but who, as God-fearers and Gentiles, did not like the cultic apparatus that went along with this, such as circumcision, such as kosher patterns of eating food, and other kinds of prohibitions. We are inclined now to believe that what Paul did was go and preach to Jewish synagogues, and was generally unsuccessful in that, but was probably very successful in appealing to diaspora synagogue attending God-fearers. And therefore, he had a built-in audience, and that became the beginnings of the Gentile portion of the Christian movement. A sixth item, by way of general information, concerns the Roman Empire. We really need to get a clear picture of the Roman Empire. In the empire, the Romans ruled by terror. They ruled in many ways much as the Nazis did, although the Romans were brilliant engineers creating highways and bridges, and they were brilliant legal experts. They had a legal system that was absolutely majestic. We therefore ought not too quickly to condemn the Roman Empire, because in many ways it was indeed great. But in terms of the Jewish world into which Jesus was born, here they were dealing with Rome as an occupying force. Some of their own people, Jews, had gone to work for Rome as tax collectors. This would be, in more modern times, called a quisling. And absentee landlordism occurred all throughout what we now call the Holy Land or Israel. These were factors in the overlordship of Rome that was very important to the coming of the Christian movement. Now, most of the writings we have in the New Testament were written quite late, with the exception of the letters of Paul. The first of the Gospels is Mark, and it doesn't come till about the year 70, 40 years after the events described. Matthew and Luke are probably dated around 90. That's 60 years after the events. The Gospel of John probably doesn't come to around 100. And many ask, why were these writings so late? Why are there no writings absolutely contemporary to the life of Jesus? And the reason may be manifold, but perhaps primarily is because most of the earliest followers of Jesus, though not all of them, expected a return of Jesus, expected an apocalyptic surprise, the coming again of Jesus, the parousia, as it's called, or the end of the age and the setting up of the kingdom of God. And so, why write anything down about Jesus when he will come again soon? We can ask him face to face. Now, the canonical question, as an eighth item of general information, is this. The Hebrew Scriptures in Jesus' time had not yet been formally canonized or made official, although Torah was obviously treated as official, considered official, and accepted as official. But the series of writings that we now call the Hebrew Scriptures of the Old Testament were not canonized until after the death of Jesus and at about the time that Matthew and Luke were being written, or 90 of this common era. And ninth and finally, by way of general information, Hebrew was a language by Jesus' time for scholars. Greek was the language of merchants, Jewish and otherwise, and Aramaic was the language of the people. It is very likely that Jesus offered all of his teachings in the Aramaic language, and thus, given the fact that the New Testament is written in Greek, we know that already it has gone through one translation from the Aramaic words of Jesus to the Greek written words of the New Testament. We have to deal with that. It is very likely, in my view, that Jesus did speak Greek, although not all scholars are in agreement on that. And the reason that that's my view is because the city of Nazareth, in the time that Jesus was being raised in the lower Galilee, was only 3.5 miles from a city called Sepphoris. It is inappropriate to call Nazareth a city. It was a village of perhaps 200 people. But Sepphoris was an emerging, sophisticated, cultivated, Hellenistic city and the administrative headquarters of the lower Galilee. Therefore, Jesus was within a few miles of a very sophisticated social, cultural, governmental environment. It is impossible for me to believe, therefore, that our classic images of Jesus as a kind of a rural rustic, though all of his illustrations tend to be rural and rustic, it's hard for me to believe he's really a rural rustic in the sense we've often thought when he lived so near such a highly cultured city. Now, another thing we know and have discovered in more recent years is that the Christian movement following the death of Jesus began in a very strange way. Most movements, for example, in modern times, communism, begin with an author figure or a hero figure or a cult leader, and for a while all the followers are together. And then with the death of the cult leader, his followers begin to interpret him or his words differently, and you get a split in the movement. You can image a tree, for example. There's the trunk that begins, and then a couple of limbs spread off, and then that from that, more limbs spread off. And before long, you have many different points of view interpreting the founding parent of that particular religious or political expression. That happened in communism in our time. As, for example, when the movement began to split immediately after the death of Lenin, and you had Trotsky, who eventually fled to Mexico, you had Stalin, and eventually you got in communism all these little limbs, such as North Korean communism, Chinese communism, Russian communism, Yugoslavian communism, Cuban communism, and each of them expresses itself in a little different way. Now, that's what one would expect of a movement, but the Christian movement really didn't begin that way. We know that within a very brief period of time after Jesus' death, there were several important and differing perceptions of who Jesus was and how he was to be followed as the Master. For example, let me just give three illustrations. There's a community that developed that's called the Q community. And if you have before you a document that we have called the Developing New Testament and a second one called the Dual Tradition in the New Testament, you will see that after Jesus, and particularly if you look at the Dual Tradition in the New Testament, after Jesus, two particular developments took place, one that we called a Sayings Tradition and the other a Christ Myth Tradition. And by this, it is meant that one group who were followers of Jesus followed him as a teacher. They focused upon what he said. They concentrated on some of his parables and his aphorisms and his pithy sayings. And they followed Jesus as a teacher, a master. They were disciples. Another tradition developed, largely as a result of the activities of the Apostle Paul, who had never met Jesus, never knew him, and really wasn't interested in Jesus in the physical sense. He was only interested in what he referred to as his experience of the Christ, the risen Jesus. And out of Paul comes a Christ myth. And as the sayings tradition emphasized Jesus' words, Paul emphasized not Jesus' words, but the events in Jesus' life. So you get two different ways of following Jesus. And out of the Pauline point of view comes what we call the Christ myth tradition. The sayings tradition eventually gets embodied in a document called that we call Q, from the German Quelle, which means source, because we have this document in no exact written form, but we have it embedded within Luke and Matthew. In 90 of this common era, Luke and Matthew drew upon a written tradition from early in the development of the Christian movement, embedded within their two documents, but it comes out a little differently in each, particularly in terms of context. We know that Q as a written document probably existed and that it was used as a source for both Luke and Matthew, but was not used as a source for the earliest of the four Gospels, namely Mark. So we have the Q community. We have a second community, the Pauline community or communities, emphasizing the events of Jesus' life rather than the teachings of Jesus' life. In fact, in the letters of Paul, he virtually quotes Jesus not at all. And then we have a third group that comes into existence that's different from either the Q group, as we call it, or the Pauline group, as we refer to it, and that's the Jerusalem church itself, the mother church of the Christian movement. This is a great mystery to most scholars, because the Jerusalem church, while composed of the so-called original 12, that is 11 of them with one to replace Judas, while it's composed of the 12 apostles, as we sometimes refer to them, this church comes immediately under control of the family of Jesus. We know that Jesus' mother was named Mary, father was Joseph, and that Jesus had at least four brothers and several sisters. The brothers are named in the New Testament, James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon. And the family apparently rejected Jesus during his lifetime, and yet immediately after his death, they take charge of the mother church of the Christian movement, something very, very difficult to be understood. And very quickly, James, Jesus' younger brother, becomes the mevachar, or the episkopos, or the bishop, of this mother church of the Christian movement. It has an organizational pattern, incidentally, and purity codes and mealtime practices that are very similar to that of the Essenes. Even its nomenclature and organization is like that, and it's very apocalyptic. That is, expecting the return of Jesus. The Q community in the very beginning was probably not apocalyptic. Paul probably was apocalyptic. The Jerusalem church was apocalyptic. And the Jerusalem church followed the Peshar method of interpretation by searching the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures for any references that might be applied to Jesus at all, and then they applied that reference to Jesus, whether the original writer intended that or not. The Essenes, 100 years before the birth of Jesus, had a baptism service and had a messianic meal composed of bread and wine. But of course, a bread and wine meal was typical of other religious expressions for several centuries before the Common Era, so that as it came into use in the Christian tradition, it was not wholly unlike that of some other traditions. The conclusion to all of this is as follows, at least from my point of view. If the Christian movement had begun, as most movements do, with the trunk of the tree and then gradually splitting off with followers and splitting more with further followers following in time sequence much later, we would then say that Jesus made very clear what he had in mind. He had a program and he had a message that at least initially was clearly understood. But the fact that immediately almost upon his death, several very significant differing and divergent expressions of what he had said and done suddenly appeared would suggest to me two or three things. First, that Jesus did not have a program, and therefore his followers had to create the program. Secondly, his teachings apparently were polyvalent, That is, they could be interpreted in more than one way, and hence you get divergent expressions. And thirdly, the power of the continuing presence or influence of Jesus on his followers must have been very great indeed. We refer this, of course, to the idea of the risen Christ and of the resurrection. But apart from the cultic or religious characteristics of that, the evidence is overwhelming that there was some kind of a powerful, abiding sense of Jesus' presence, at least among many of his followers. But it expressed itself very, very differently among them. Now, another thing we know and have discovered in more recent years is that the Christian movement, following the death of Jesus, began in a very strange way. Most movements, for example, in modern times, communism, begin with an author figure or a hero figure or a cult leader, and for a while all the followers are together. And then with the death of the cult leader, his followers begin to interpret him or his words differently, and you get a split in the movement. You can image a tree, for example. There's the trunk that begins, and then a couple of limbs spread off, and then that from that, more limbs spread off. And before long, you have many different points of view interpreting the founding parent of that particular religious or political expression. That happened in communism in our time. As, for example, when the movement began to split immediately after the death of Lenin, and you had Trotsky, who eventually fled to Mexico, you had Stalin, and eventually you got in communism all these little limbs, such as North Korean communism, Chinese communism, Russian communism, Yugoslavian communism, Cuban communism, and each of them expresses itself in a little different way. Now, that's what one would expect of a movement, but the Christian movement really didn't begin that way. We know that within a very brief period of time after Jesus' death, there were several important and differing perceptions of who Jesus was and how he was to be followed as the Master. For example, let me just give three illustrations. There's a community that developed that's called the Q community. And if you have before you a document that we have called the Developing New Testament and a second one called the Dual Tradition in the New Testament, you will see that after Jesus, and particularly if you look at the Dual Tradition in the New Testament, after Jesus, two particular developments took place, one that we called a Sayings Tradition and the other a Christ Myth Tradition. And by this, it is meant that one group who were followers of Jesus followed him as a teacher. They focused upon what he said. They concentrated on some of his parables and his aphorisms and his pithy sayings. And they followed Jesus as a teacher, a master. They were disciples. Another tradition developed largely as a result of the activities of the Apostle Paul, who had never met Jesus, never knew him, and really wasn't interested in Jesus in the physical sense. He was only interested in what he referred to as his experience of the Christ, the risen Jesus. And out of Paul comes a Christ myth. And as the sayings tradition emphasized Jesus' words, Paul emphasized not Jesus' words, but the events in Jesus' life. So you get two different ways of following Jesus. And out of the Pauline point of view comes what we call the Christ myth tradition. The sayings tradition eventually gets embodied in a document called that we call Q, from the German Quelle, which means source, because we have this document in no exact written form, but we have it embedded within Luke and Matthew. In 90 of this common era, Luke and Matthew drew upon a written tradition from early in the development of the Christian movement, embedded within their two documents, but it comes out a little differently in each, particularly in terms of context. We know that Q as a written document probably existed and that it was used as a source for both Luke and Matthew, but was not used as a source for the earliest of the four Gospels, namely Mark. So we have the Q community. We have a second community, the Pauline community or communities, emphasizing the events of Jesus' life rather than the teachings of Jesus' life. In fact, in the letters of Paul, he virtually quotes Jesus not at all. And then we have a third group that comes into existence that's different from either the Q group, as we call it, or the Pauline group, as we refer to it, and that's the Jerusalem church itself, the mother church of the Christian movement. This is a great mystery to most scholars, because the Jerusalem church, while composed of the so-called original 12, that is 11 of them with one to replace Judas, while it's composed of the 12 apostles, as we sometimes refer to them, this church comes immediately under control of the family of Jesus. We know that Jesus' mother was named Mary, father was Joseph, and that Jesus had at least four brothers and several sisters. The brothers are named in the New Testament, James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon. And the family apparently rejected Jesus during his lifetime, and yet immediately after his death, they take charge of the mother church of the Christian movement, something very, very difficult to be understood. And very quickly, James, Jesus' younger brother, becomes the mevachar, or the episkopos, or the bishop, of this mother church of the Christian movement. It has an organizational pattern, incidentally, and purity codes and mealtime practices that are very similar to that of the Essenes. Even its nomenclature and organization is like that, and it's very apocalyptic. That is, expecting the return of Jesus. The Q community in the very beginning was probably not apocalyptic. Paul probably was apocalyptic. The Jerusalem church was apocalyptic. And the Jerusalem church followed the Peshar method of interpretation by searching the Old Testament or the Hebrew scriptures for any references that might be applied to Jesus at all, and then they applied that reference to Jesus, whether the original writer intended that or not. The Essenes, 100 years before the birth of Jesus, had a baptism service and had a messianic meal composed of bread and wine. But of course, a bread and wine meal was typical of other religious expressions for several centuries before the Common Era, so that as it came into use in the Christian tradition, it was not wholly unlike that of some other traditions. The conclusion to all of this is as follows, at least from my point of view. If the Christian movement had begun, as most movements do, with the trunk of the tree and then gradually splitting off with followers and splitting more with further followers following in time sequence much later, we would then say that Jesus made very clear what he had in mind. He had a program and he had a message that at least initially was clearly understood. But the fact that immediately almost upon his death, several very significant differing and divergent expressions of what he had said and done suddenly appeared would suggest to me two or three things. First, that Jesus did not have a program, and therefore his followers had to create the program. Secondly, his teachings apparently were polyvalent. That is, they could be interpreted in more than one way, and hence you get divergent expressions. And thirdly, the power of the continuing presence or influence of Jesus on his followers must have been very great indeed. We refer this, of course, to the idea of the risen Christ and of the resurrection. But apart from the cultic or religious characteristics of that, the evidence is overwhelming that there was some kind of a powerful, abiding sense of Jesus' presence, at least among many of his followers. But it expressed itself very, very differently among them. Now, the first writings, therefore, of the New Testament are really the writings of the Apostle Paul. Apostle is an awkward word to use here because it means ambassador, and generally we spoke of the 12 apostles symbolizing the 12 tribes of Israel, and yet Paul refers to himself as an apostle who never met Jesus, never knew Jesus, and really wasn't interested in the physical Jesus or the historic man. He was interested only in his experience of the risen Christ. And he was converted sometime a few years after the life and death of Jesus, on the road to Damascus, presumably according to the Acts of the Apostles, and he immediately began to go out into the wider world of diaspora Judaism, trying to convert fellow Jews, he was a Jew himself, to the Christian faith or to the belief that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah. As suggested earlier, failing in this, he began to turn to what I think were the God-fearers and began to be increasingly successful in reaching Gentiles with his particular message. We have nothing written by Paul for the first approximately 18 years of his ministry of this kind. Therefore, those are silent years as far as knowing what Paul was saying. The fact is likely that he wrote many letters during that period of time because he was a letter writer, and they simply have been lost in the shuffle. He probably was not considered too important during that period of time for his letters to be saved. But beginning with his earliest letters that we do have, we are in a period approximately 18 years removed from his so-called conversion, the silent years. I'm personally persuaded that during those silent years, that the God-fearers whom he was reaching successfully influenced Paul. Paul had begun as a Jew, but by the time we begin to read his first letters, Paul has in effect shelved the law, shelved Hebrew scriptures, and begun to say that you are saved by grace alone, not by the law, not by obedience to it, not by practicing the Jewish way of life, not by circumcision, and so forth. I'm personally persuaded that he may have been influenced strongly in this by those whom he converted, the God-fearers who had bought into the package of one God, Yahweh, and a righteous life, but simply didn't go along with the notion of cultic practices like circumcision, kosher eating, and the like. I think they influenced Paul to see that the Christian faith didn't need that, and very quickly Paul changed to his dramatic doctrine of grace. Now, not all of the letters in the New Testament attributed to Paul were written by him. In the next session, we're going to talk about who the historic Jesus was, but in this session, we want to wrap it up by talking about the first or earliest writings in the New Testament, and they are the letters of Paul, who never knew Jesus. And not all the letters in the New Testament attributed to Paul were written by him, which is a mark of his powerful influence upon one wing of the emerging Christian movement, the one wing, by the way, that will finally become triumphant and end in the proto-Catholic Church and ultimately the Orthodox churches of the East and the Catholic churches of the West, and finally, of course, in modern Protestantism growing out of that. His letters are existential. They are written to that moment in time and certain problems of developing young congregations or house churches. They were probably all meeting in houses at that time. They are letters, therefore, not theological treatises, with the possible exception of Romans. Anyone who reads the letters of Paul carefully will find that from time to time he says something a little differently from what he had said earlier. And it is not uncommon to find contradictions between one writing of Paul and another. This simply represents the fact that these are letters. They are not theological treatises. They are addressed to the needs of young congregations and in that sense are very existential. Paul tells us very little about himself, and the material in Luke, Acts, they being originally one book, the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, now separated in most Bibles. The material in Luke, Acts is probably seriously distorted in relation to the life of Paul due to an apologetic interest. The apologetic interest is simply this. Paul did not always get along well with the Jerusalem church or the mother church of the Christian movement. And therefore, some late writer in the first century, the author of Luke, Acts, tries to put this together and say the movement did indeed begin very, very comfortably, a movement in which everybody loved one another, they didn't disagree on anything, and all things went smoothly from the beginning. In fact, nothing of that sort happened at all. Paul never knew Jesus, as we've already pointed out, and to make it even more explicit, in 2 Corinthians 5:16, he says, "From now on, therefore, we are not interested in anyone from a human point of view, even though we once may have known Christ from a human point of view, we are interested in that no longer." Well, this states very clearly and very explicitly the fact that he was interested in the Christ figure, the Savior figure, the Redeemer figure, or what we call in scholarly terms the Christ myth. And by myth, once again, I want to remind you, we don't mean anything having to do with being true or false. A myth is either living or dead, and it was the living way of explaining and understanding Jesus for Paul and those who followed in his way. Paul's central emphasis was as follows. He insisted there are two ways of being human, the old way and the new way, and we need a new way to be human in a new age, in which we are justified, blessed, approved by God, living by faith, no longer by the law, and in the power of the Spirit, and destined for eternal life. Paul, however, curiously, does not really define faith in any of his letters. Is it belief in a series of ideas? Is it a culture in which we're supposed to trust? Is it a deposit of information? Or is it simply faith as trust in God, as experienced for Paul in Jesus? He really never defines the word faith in that sense, clearly. Paul envisions a community in which there are no social distinctions, although later on he points out that there are differing ways of behavior for men and women. But he really defines a community with no social distinctions, in which he writes in Galatians 3:28, "In Christ there's no such thing as a Jew or a Greek, slave or free man, male or female, for you have all become one in Christ Jesus." Paul saw grace as prevenient. That is to say, grace comes first and is a free gift and not in any way as a result of human effort. Human effort comes later. We do not do good to experience the love of God. We experience the love of God, said Paul, and once having experienced that, we want to do good. He fitted in with the culture of his time, even in terms of his Jewishness. That is to say, there were certain roles that men ought to play and certain roles that women ought to play, even though he suggested there ought to be no social distinctions in the church. But he did fit in with the culture of his time without any question. The key to Paul goes something like this. If you follow Torah, in order to win God's approval, you will fail. If you do so in order not to offend others and to live morally because of your love of them and of God, you will find fulfillment. If you strive for acceptance, you will fail. But if you strive within acceptance, you will be truly free and truly human. That's the core of what Paul was about. Now, his earliest writing is 1 Thessalonians. It's the earliest writing from the Christian movement in any way, shape, or form. Paul, in this document, writing to the Thessalonians, asserts the imminence of Jesus coming again with the idea of the rapture. If you're here when Jesus comes again, you will be taken to heaven to be with him. I am fully persuaded that at this time, Paul did not expect ever to die. He expected to be raptured. Paul defends himself against various accusations. He did this very often in his letters, indicating he must have been a very controversial figure as he moved around amongst the various Jewish synagogues trying to effect conversion. Some of these accusations he defends himself against include, who really wrote this document? Did Paul or did someone else? What does Paul really believe? Does he suggest the church be obedient to Jerusalem or develop a life of its own? I could go on with all kinds of these things. Whom were the Gentiles whom he was converting? How can they continue to be Gentiles and also be Jews? Well, they don't have to be Jews, according to Paul, and this caused trouble amongst fellow Jews. Well, we could go on with this, but this is the broad background of Paul's writings, and that's the broad background of 1 Thessalonians. Now, two or three things come out of this that we subsequently know. For one thing, we are reasonably assured that James, the bishop or superintendent of the mother church of the Christian movement, in which the rest of Jesus' own family was present, and in which the original 11 apostles were present, and many of the original believers apparently, the mother church of the Christian movement continued to practice Judaism with the addition of an understanding that Jesus, their Messiah, had come. In fact, there were so many different expressions of Judaism at that time, as we've alluded to earlier, that the evidence would suggest James, the younger physical brother of Jesus and bishop of this first Christian community, was respected greatly by all his fellow Jews, not by those who accepted Jesus. Josephus alludes to this. Other evidences are found of this. Apparently, until his own martyrdom in 62 of this common era, James was viewed as a towering presence in the Jewish community as a Jew. A second thing that ought to be noted as a result of this, if you had been a member of this infant movement called Christian somewhere back at that time, let us say around the year 40, you would have undoubtedly known of Peter. You might have known of Paul if you were in the diaspora, Judaism. But the fact is, the towering figure of the emerging movement at that time was neither Peter nor Paul, but James, the younger physical brother of Jesus, who had not even apparently accepted Jesus during his older brother's lifetime. This is an astonishing bit of information, and I think represents the best of information that we can gain in that period, and how we explain it is one of the great mysteries of the emergence of the Christian movement. But to repeat, if you had been a Christian in, let us say, North Africa or Egypt, you would have certainly known of Peter. You had heard about the others of the company of 12. But the towering presence would have been James, and you might not even have heard of Paul. But to continue with Paul, after this extraordinary letter to the Galatians, which you ought to read for yourself very carefully, alongside the book of Acts in the New Testament, the next letter was to the church at Philippi, the Philippians. It's Paul's one letter that is truly joyful. He was a prisoner at the time, opposed by many other Christians and facing death. But it's a joyful letter. His joy was reflected in the notion, I have learned, and I'm quoting, to be satisfied with whatever condition it is in which I find myself. And we're sort of back to the prayer of Reinhold Niebuhr. O Lord, grant me the grace to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That feeling tone is certainly in the letter of Paul's called Philippians. The next letter, chronologically, is his letter to Philemon. It's a charming letter sent to a fellow Christian about a convert to the Christian movement and a runaway slave, Onesimus. And Paul writes to Philemon, who is the owner of Onesimus, and slavery, of course, was practiced in that period of time rather considerably. It's a letter back to the owner of this slave, Philemon, in which, in very tactful words, you really need to read it for yourself, Paul says, why don't you receive him back, not as your property and a slave, but as your son in the faith? It's a very interesting letter, very beautiful letter. It raises all kinds of interesting questions about what Paul believed about slavery. Did Paul endorse slavery? Well, it's hard to know from this letter. He certainly did not deliberately advocate its abolition. Why did both Judaism and Christianity accept slavery for so long a time? To what extent is faith as a belief system shaped more by the wider culture than by that which you believe about, for example, the teachings of the founding member Jesus? What is the role of Jew or Christian, acquiescence or antagonism? That is, in the face of an evil such as slavery, do you go along with the wider culture? Do you raise intellectual questions, or do you engage in combat? In other words, did Paul believe in passive or active resistance? And one goes back to Jesus and begins to wonder about some of the words of Jesus, which we'll discuss in the next session. Go the second mile, return good for evil. If a man asks of you your cloak, give him your coat also. Most people don't understand what Jesus meant by that, really, because Jesus lived in a two-garment society. He was therefore saying, if your cloak is asked for you, give him your coat also and be totally naked. The next of Paul's letters is really something a little more than a letter. It is a theological treatise. Unlike his other letters, It is theological to the core. His other letters are existential. They deal with problems of the time. They talk about practical considerations. But the letter to the Romans is really theology. And the letter to the Romans has had the most profound impact upon the church of any New Testament writing, including the Gospels. It shaped the theology of St. Augustine, of Martin Luther, of John Calvin, of John Wesley, of Karl Barth in this century, who was such a towering presence during the 1930s and 40s. And it is the only clearly theological writing of Paul. The key is found in Romans, the first chapter, the 16th and 17th verses, in which he writes, "I am not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith, for faith. As it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith." Well, as we suggested in a session on the prophets, this is Habakkuk he's quoting. And he is suggesting that salvation is by faith and not by works. Original sin, he recognizes in this document, which is generally not recognized by those who interpret most of the portions of the Hebrew Scriptures, but he raises up the notion of original sin, which was embellished marvelously by St. Augustine, in which all persons are sinners. Further, the Gentiles cannot plead ignorance because they have had some vision of God, and once the vision of Jesus comes to them, they ought to recognize it. The Jews have always had more knowledge of God than other peoples, according to Paul in Romans. God does for us, he continues, however, God does for us what we simply cannot do for ourselves. We cannot save ourselves. And therefore, we must depend upon a new self, a new humanity in Jesus, and this is purely a gift from God. He writes further in Romans that the Jews will eventually come to Jesus. Will eventually come to Jesus. Now, some questions are raised immediately by Romans. Is the issue as to the way of salvation really this polarized? Many of you will recall one of the great classics of American literature was written by William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience, in which he pointed out there is more than one way to have a wonderful experience of the divine. And he outlined this in a classic document that is really scientific in nature or intent, but is a theological statement as well. And we have to ask, is the issue as to the way of salvation only to be defined as Paul has defined it, only by one way, with one understanding, and nobody else can have salvation except by that way? And a second question that is raised by this, how has this doctrine and this idea, particularly as it's been developed by St. Augustine and then subsequently by Martin Luther, how has it affected Jewish-Christian relationships over the centuries? Martin Luther, you may remember, began with a warm, friendly, cordial attitude toward the Jews, built around the notion in Romans that the Jews all finally would convert to the way of Jesus. But when they did not convert, in the latter years of Martin Luther's life, he turned fiercely anti-Semitic and even wrote letters saying we ought to burn down the synagogues of the Jewish people in Germany. These were prefatory remarks to a man by the name of Adolf Hitler, I'm sorry to say. How has this understanding of the letter to the Romans affected Jewish-Christian relations is the question. And what of the exclusivist view of Jesus as the only way into the presence of a gracious God? We will, in the next session, discuss the teachings of Jesus, this parable maker. And if there's one thing that was absolutely characteristic of Jesus, was the fact that he was inclusive in his view of people. Paul is very exclusive here in his understanding of salvation. And of course, all religions are shaped by boundary building, us and them, what we believe and what they do not believe, how one should live and how they do live. All religions exist by boundaries. We define religions by alluding to their boundaries, what they believe, how they behave in contrast to what someone else believes or how someone else behaves. What of this exclusivist view, this boundary building? Is this to follow in the way of Jesus, or is it to follow in the way more of Paul and of classic religionists? These are the kind of questions that are raised by this very early writing in the history of the Christian movement, written before any gospel had been written. Paul never had a gospel to read. Written before any of the other letters in the New Testament had been written. Written before the Acts of the Apostles had been written, and so forth. Colossians comes next, and finally, several letters that are attributed to Paul that he really didn't write. Colossians is, according to John Calvin, of an inestimable treasure because of its emphasis on a cosmic Christ. It was most likely written by a disciple of Paul, though it could have been written by Paul, and some insist it must have been. Its emphasis is that Christ versus the cosmic powers and heavenly life in Christ will be that which triumphs over the old earthly life of the powers and persuasions of what we would call, or what Paul would have called, paganism. It uses, interestingly enough, wisdom language. In it, there's a hymn of praise to Christ that is very like a wisdom hymn of praise. And God is fully in Jesus, not partially so. Finally, there are several letters we know that, or are reasonably assured, were not written by Paul. Ephesians, Samuel Taylor Coleridge called this the divinest composition of man. It has a high doctrine of the church. The work of Christ is almost described in Gnostic language. There is an absence in Ephesians of any expectation of Christ's return. And grace over law is very clearly stated, which is plainly a Pauline view, though this is not Paul's letter. In Ephesians, the second chapter, verses 15 through 18, he writes, Christ has abolished the law with its commandments and ordinances that he might create in himself one new humanity in place of the two, thus making peace and might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. Well, when you read this, you must remember that when he writes he has abolished the law, he is really writing he has abolished Hebrew Scripture. 2 Thessalonians, unlike 1 Thessalonians, this letter is not very personal. Probably was not written by Paul. Persecution was occurring. They were expecting the day of the Lord. Patient endurance was recommended. And then the pastoral epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, are attributed to Paul, but come very, very late and are meant to justify the coming into existence of an institutional church. We'll discuss those later because they are late, not written by Paul, and obviously proto-Catholic. Concluding questions very quickly. Q community and Paul have a very different view of things. Q would be closer to James than Paul. For the Q community, the law was still valuable, but not the only thing. The teachings of Jesus were best. Repentance leads to forgiveness, and then the life of Jesus was central. The Q community does not find the cross a crucial factor in salvation, nor even the notion of resurrection. And Q, in its final form, does not agree with Paul on Jesus' expected return, which may have fitted very well, however, the community in Jerusalem. We have a mixed beginning to a movement that would reshape the history of Western Europe.